It's good to see each one this evening. We're glad that you're here. We want you to feel welcome. And remind you of the question period that will follow in theoretically about 30 minutes. We're talking this evening about the subject of creation science and what it is. There's been an awful lot of misrepresentation on this subject, especially in the popular press. Basically, creation science is a search for truth based on the evidence that we see in the natural world around us. Most often from this pulpit, you hear people proclaiming what the Bible says, and there's much evidence in the Bible, and I enjoy doing that. But there are many people in this world who have been convinced that the Bible is not the Word of God and are not persuaded by it, and I think we need to start where they are and deal with the science that usually has taken them away from faith in the Word of God. Just looking at that area, which they do generally accept, we can show reason for faith in what the Bible says. But let's look at the evidence to consider it. We're searching for the truth. The situation is much like the fellow you may have heard about who was sculpting the elephant, just doing a marvelous job. His friends came in and looked at it and said, "That's just spectacular. How in the world do you do that?" He said, "It's real simple. You just begin with a big block of rock and you knock off everything that doesn't look like an elephant." We start with a body of evidence and we examine it. And we knock off everything that won't stand the examination. And there are some arguments I used to make. I don't make anymore because I learned that needs to be knocked off. It won't stand. We're searching for the truth. When we seek to define creation science, I think a good place to start is with the proclamation made by Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia in the Edwards versus Aguilar case where they were discussing creation science. They said, "We have no basis on the record to conclude that creation science need be anything other than a collection of scientific data supporting the theory that life abruptly appeared on the earth." I think that's an excellent definition. It has nothing to do with what's in the Sunday school class or what's in Genesis chapter 3. This is a different subject. This has to do with the scientific data and what it implies with regard to the abrupt appearance of life on the earth. That's what we're going to be looking at for the rest of this week. The facts, the evidence that we see from science. But some people have a hard time imagining how you could look at science and see the difference between the concepts of creation and evolution just from the facts. And it's really not that complex. Let me illustrate. You look at this rock, and I ask you, how did this originate? Did someone design this? Was this from intelligent design, or did this just happen? Well, more than likely, this just happened. On the other hand, you look at this rock, and do you think that just happened? Really? Now, when you conclude this came about as a result of created design, are you involved in a religious process or something that has to be relegated to the Sunday school classroom? Can't teach this in school, it's religion. No, you look at the empirical evidence and you can determine what happened naturally and what happened by intelligent design. Let's look at another illustration. You walk along the beach and you see these lines lined up parallel to the shore. Now, they're organized, they're lined up. Was this the result of intelligent design or natural processes? Well, you see they're parallel to the shoreline, and you can watch this happen about every 12 hours, and you conclude this probably was the result of natural processes. And as you continue to walk along the shore, you see something else. John loves Mary. Well, the waves probably did that. You think? You're going to buy that? But now, wait a minute. When you discern intelligent design, you're involved in a religious process? No, this is science. This is looking at the empirical evidence and distinguishing between what is designed and what is natural. And don't let anybody tell you that has to be a religious process and can't be in the classroom. That's what we're going to be looking at, and that's what creation science is. It is an examination of the scientific data. Now, the little tail that you see wagging around up here is one illustration of the kind of thing that we'll be looking at. This is the bacterial flagellum. This is the tail on a bacteria that propels it. It's turned by a motor. Now, it's microscopic, but the parts of this motor are exactly like the electric motors that you see that are designed by engineers. It has rotors. It has a stator. It has O-rings. It has bushings. It has U-joints. It has a drive shaft. And through the same process that we see with other electric motors, it turns that shaft. It has 30 coordinated functioning parts, each one dependent on the other, so that if one's missing, it won't function. But all of this is supposed to just happen. Now, you walk along the beach and you see a motor laying out there, and it's running, turning at 100,000 revolutions per minute. And you say, well, I guess the waves just did that. I think that you'd be a candidate for the funny farm. This is crazy. But you see that with the bacteria, and all of a sudden this just happened all by itself. Richard Dawkins, who is one of the most rabid atheists in the world, anti-creationist, makes this acknowledgement in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. He says, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, that's how you define biology. Biology is such that it just looks designed, but of course he doesn't believe it is. But it looks that way. Well, why not think possibly it is what it looks like? Especially when you see things like that motor with all of the parts. Francis Crick, who's a Nobel laureate, makes a similar statement. He says, biologists must constantly keep in mind, of course he's an atheist, we must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Now, if you don't keep that in mind, you might be led astray, but you've got to work at this and make sure you're not led astray by what it looks like. Well, what's wrong with just going to what it looks like? Well, if you're going to be an atheist, you can't do that. We need to understand that there are two basic ideas, and only two. Either things developed slowly and gradually, naturally, or they were suddenly created, and really there are no alternatives when we're talking about origins. Notice the statement by Douglas Batuma, who's one of the leading anti-creationists in the country. He says, creation and evolution between them exhaust the possible explanations for the origin of living things. Organisms either appeared on Earth fully developed, or they did not. If they did not, then they must have developed from pre-existing species from some process of modification. It's just one or the other. Sometimes people say, well, if you teach both, then you have to allow all of these other ideas. They're really just two variations of each, but just two. Philosophically, you have no other alternatives. And that has another important implication. Sometimes people will make the false accusation that we're only presenting evidence against evolution, not for creation. If you're here for the rest of the week, you'll see that certainly is not true. But if there's only A or B, and you show it's not B, you're against B. What have you done to A? You have established that. And so there are clear implications when we understand there are just two. And you don't have to allow all of these others. But we're told that you can only have one in the classroom, because otherwise you're teaching religion in the schoolroom. I think that's a very naive conclusion. I believe both creation and evolution can be investigated scientifically. I think we have demonstrated that. Doesn't have to be in the Sunday school classroom. We can demonstrate and examine both scientifically. Both creation and evolution certainly have profound religious implications. Well, people say, I understand the creation does, but does evolution have religious implications? Well, I think there are profound religious implications. Let's notice some of the leading proponents of the naturalistic philosophy that dominates our educational system. Edward Erickson would certainly qualify. He's writing in the publication The Humanist, and he's talking about naturalism, which is the philosophy that textbooks are governed by. The core of the humanistic philosophy is naturalism, the proposition that the natural world proceeds according to its own internal dynamics without divine or supernatural control or guidance, and that we human beings are creations of that process. Does this have religious implications? Well, obviously it does. Naturalist cannot escape this and the religious implications associated with it. Richard Lewontin, one of the more famous biologists in the world from Harvard, says, it is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a materialistic explanation of the phenomenal world. And of course, when they look at the world around us, they have accepted this materialistic explanation. That's all that's allowed in the classroom. Well, why do they do it? Well, it's not science that says you must have a materialistic explanation. On the contrary, he says, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation, a set of concepts that produce material explanations. We have just made up our mind that we're going to have material causes. And so since we've done that, then we have to have apparatus that produces material results. No matter how counterintuitive, even if it looks nuts, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, this is the philosophy that dominates our educational system, and don't tell me there are not religious implications. They are profound. Steven Pinker of MIT likewise expresses the implications of this naturalistic philosophy. He said, no evidence would be sufficient to create a change of mind. Now, we get the idea sometimes that materialistic scientists are just open-minded to go wherever the evidence leads. No. No evidence would be sufficient to create a change in mind. That it is not a commitment to evidence, but a commitment to naturalism. You're going to be naturalistic because you have decided to be naturalistic, and evidence doesn't matter. You're going to be naturalistic anyway. Because there are no alternatives. Well, that's not really true. The only alternative is God, and he's rejected that, and so he says there is no alternative. We would almost have to accept natural selection as the explanation of life on the planet, even if there were no evidence for it. Because the only alternative is God, and we're not going to go that way. We're going to be naturalists, he said. But this commitment to naturalism has just tremendously profound implications, and to say one's religious and one isn't is very naive. And that's a nice way to put it. And it obviously is a matter of faith on their part that this naturalistic world is all there is. Isaac Asimov puts it this way, and he's one of the more famous atheists, recently deceased. He says, I have faith and believe myself. I believe that nothing beyond those natural laws is needed. I have no evidence for this. It's simply what I have faith in. It's what I believe. He hasn't proved naturalism. He doesn't try to prove naturalism. He just believes it because he has decided to believe it. And then that's what is allowed and only what's allowed in the classroom. He is a devout believer. And when you think about what unbelievers have to believe, it really gets to be amazing. They have to believe that a big explosion produced all of the order in the universe. Now that's a great leap of faith. They believe that molecules self-assemble and become living cells all by themselves. They believe that errors in complex genetic systems produce even more complexity. I have not seen such great faith in all Israel. They're great believers, but blind believers, not based on the evidence, but I think in spite of it. But it certainly is a faith, and it is a religion. In fact, just late last year, there was a very important court decision reported here in August of 06. Federal Court of Appeals ruled yesterday Wisconsin prison officials officiated an inmate's right, violated inmate's rights because they did not treat atheism as a religion. Atheism is a religion. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. It is religious. It has profound religious implications, and the courts of the land say you're going to be in trouble if you don't treat it as a religion. So don't let the teacher say one's religious and one isn't. It's not so. It's just foolish to say so. Michael Ruse is one of the leading philosophers of science in the country. He's testified at most of the trials dealing with the subject. He says evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than mere science. And he's talking about those who preach it, and mentions Dawkins, who are more rabid, he says, than fundamentalist preachers. He says evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with its meaning and morality. That's a scary statement when you think about the implications of determining morality by principles of evolution. Survival of the fittest, might makes right. As Darwin said, evolution, the naturalistic world, the fang is red. And that's what causes the progress. This is what produces morality. Anyway, that's what he's saying. Evolution is a religion. And to just blindly ignore that, I don't think is very honest. But our tax dollars are paying for this religion. The Constitution says we can't have an established religion in this country, but we do. And we're paying for it with our tax money. The Chicago Field Museum is one example of that. Interesting statement was made recently, reported in the Chicago Tribune last year, by the museum president. He says the whole core of the museum is evolution and its story. That's what this museum is about. And we pay for it. He says in recent years, it's dedicated a lot of resources to educate visitors about evolution. That includes spending $17 million in 2 years to recast its permanent exhibit on evolution. Now, where did that $17 million come from? It came out of my pocket, your pocket, tax dollars, establishing this religion to the exclusion of all others. Propaganda is the way that's defined. And our public school systems pontificate this humanistic naturalism, which is philosophically defined as a religion. Like this, here's Prentice Hall's biology textbook. There's no doubt that if you jump into the air, you'll end up on the ground. Makes no difference whether you believe or even understand or believe in gravity. What goes up must come down, just as definitely life on Earth has evolved and is continuing to evolve all around us all the time. This is what our tax dollars are paying our teachers to teach our students. Pontificating naturalistic philosophy and evolution. But some will say, isn't it true that this is maybe unfair, but it's illegal if you try to do anything else? And the press has left that impression with many, but it absolutely is not true. The Supreme Court has ruled contrary to that in the Balance Treatment Act, in Edwards versus Aguilar. Brennan wrote the majority opinion, and he is ruling against this act. It's a balanced treatment act that says you should have equal treatment of both views, and balanced treatment, that's a horrible thing to do. It's unconstitutional, and they rule so, but in that ruling, notice the reason he gave. The act does not grant teachers a flexibility they did not already possess to supplant the present science curriculum with a presentation of theories besides evolution. You already possess the ability to supplant present science curriculum with theories besides evolution about the origin of life. Teaching a variety of scientific theories about the origin of humankind to school children might be validly done with a clear secular intent. You can't do it with the purpose of teaching Genesis, but to provide good science, you teach alternative views, a variety of theories, and of course there are only two, can be validly done. And that's what the Supreme Court says. Now, maybe the principal says otherwise, but he needs to read what the Supreme Court has said. When this ruling was made, they were asking Stephen Gould, one of the leaders in evolution from Harvard, is it legal? He says, no statute exists in any state to bar instruction in creation science. It can be taught before, it can be taught now. And in spite of the hundreds of times I've seen the press saying this ruling outlawed creation science, it is not so. And our country doesn't want it that way. Back in 2003, there was a poll in Texas, and it's reflected across the country as well, but I was in Texas and saw this one. Proposition A, teach only Darwin's theory of evolution and the scientific evidence that supports. 16 people said you ought to do that. 16% of the people. That's what's being done. That's all that's taught. Just 16%, though, agree with that. On the other hand, Proposition B, teach Darwin's theory of evolution, but also the scientific evidence against it. 75% agree, but it's not being done. Now, we're supposed to live in a democracy where the voice of the people is heard. We, the people. They're not listening, and one of the reasons is we're not shouting loud enough. But 75% of the people think we ought to have both views taught, and we ought to insist that that's being done. More recently, in 04, CBS Broadcasting conducted a poll testing the proposition and stating the conclusion, Americans do not believe that humans evolved. God created humans in present form. 55% of all Americans agreed with that. On the other hand, the idea that humans evolved, God did not guide the process, only 13% agree. But that's what's being taught in the classroom, what's supported by 13%. There are a number of leading scientists who have begun to stand up and object to this. In the New Republic, this was in 2001, and since then the number has increased. There were 100 scientists that, the leading scientists from the Smithsonian, from the American Museum of Natural History, who bought a 2-page ad and took a courageous stand. They signed the statement that said, we are skeptical of the ability of random mutation, natural selection to account for the complexity of life. That evolution is taught in the textbooks. We're skeptical of that. We don't believe that'll work. 100 leading prominent scientists. Well, since then, that number has grown. That was 2001. Now then, over 700 scientists have signed that proposition, all with doctorates in the natural sciences, including scientists from U.S. National Academy of Sciences, from Russian, Polish, and Czech national academies, from such universities as Yale and Princeton and Harvard and Stanford and MIT and Columbia and Purdue and Berkeley and UCLA and Duke and Cambridge and Oxford. There were two signatories from University of Arkansas. Leading scientists are saying this is not working. But other leading scientists lie about that. Like, for example, Ernst Mayr of Harvard, who says no educated person any longer questions the validity of the so-called theory of evolution, which we now know to be a simple fact. That's a lie. And he knows it's a lie, and he says it anyway. And he's going to continue to say it, though he did pass away, I think, last year. He knows better, and of course he knew better then. Carl Sagan is more forthright and honest when he, in his book, Demon Haunted World, says only 9% of Americans accept that human beings and all of the species have slowly evolved by natural processes. Instead of all, no educated person that doesn't accept it. Well, this is the situation we're dealing with. This is the field of conflict. There have been a number of debates, and they have basically stopped it. Niles Eldridge, the American Museum of Natural History, has had a few of these debates, though he has stopped. I did debate him in Orlando, Florida. He is a professor of geology at Columbia. But in his book, Monkey Business, he makes some interesting admissions. Now, to be honest, he wrote this before I debated him. But this is what he said. Creationists today, at least the majority of their spokesmen, are highly educated, intelligent people. Skilled debaters, they've always done their homework. They nearly always seem better informed than their opponents, who are reduced too often to a bewildered state of incoherence. Do I hear an amen? That was my experience with him. He was a pushover. He had too many things that he had already written that were devastating to his position. He continues saying, creationists travel all over the United States, visiting college campuses, staging debates with biologists, geologists, anthropologists. Creationists nearly always win. And he's right. I did have a debate scheduled just a few months ago with the head of the geology department at LSU. It had been scheduled for 6 months. I showed up. About 400 students showed up. The professor didn't show. So I won. I spoke for about an hour, Q&A for another hour. The campus organization that put it on had tested the group, how many believed in creation, how many believed in evolution before, and then they followed up 2 weeks later. It seems that people who have honest minds show up for things like that, and 54% of those who did show up there were already creationists. But in the follow-up 2 weeks later, 91%. Affirm creation. That's why they don't debate. And don't say, he might have done better if he showed up, but he decided otherwise. The philosophy that dominates now is expressed by Eugenia Scott. She's usually quoted anytime somebody wants to know what evolutionists are saying, though her organization sounds important. National Center for Science Education is just a bunch of evolution haters, creation haters. But she says scientists should refuse formal debates because they do more harm than good. To them, they do more harm. And so that's not a good idea. The scientists still need to counter the creationist message. You talk about them behind their back when they're not there. Is that fair? Is that just? I think that's crazy. Darwin's view, I think, is much more fair. In Origin of the Species, he said this, a fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments from both sides of the question. Does that make sense? That's what ought to happen in our classrooms. It's not happening in our classrooms. In spite of that, we're winning the battle. I could say more about that, but let's move on. We need to define our terms if we're going to have an intelligent discussion on any subject. And let's allow the evolutionist to help us define this. G.A. Kirkut certainly qualifies. In his book, Implications of Evolution, he says there's a theory which states that many living animals can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed. And he's talking about what I would call horizontal variation. Cows get longer horns, they get shorter horns. Cats get stripes and no stripes. There's variation. Sometimes those changes are called new species. Yes, we can see some changes that are called that. I think there's no significant change going on, but yes, that's what he calls the special theory of evolution and can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiments. I don't really disagree with that when you understand what he's talking about by new species. It's illustrated with dogs, for example. We see significant difference here in the dogs in this picture. It's all one species. They interbreed, the fox, the wolf, the domestic dog. Variation is very dramatic. But it's one kind, one species even, as acknowledged by the evolutionist. This is within the kind, as I would express it. That's what he would call the special theory. But notice the distinction that he makes. On the other hand, there's a theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source. Now that's a different thought, which itself came from an inorganic form. This theory can be called the general theory of evolution. Now, This is where it's at. Not the special theory. No real issues there. The general theory, as he defines it, is where the contention is. The idea that all came from a common ancestor and all are interrelated. That there is a change not within the kind, but a change from one kind to a separate kind, a different type of individual. Now, failure to make that distinction results in just impossible communication. We see people saying, for example, I see evolution every day, and they're talking about bacteria becoming resistant to penicillin. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Evolution is not observable, the other one says, and he's talking about a change from apes into man. It takes too long, you can't see it. Now, these people sound like they're contradicting each other, but one's speaking of the special theory, the other is they're not talking about the same thing, and they're not really disagreeing, because they're not discussing the same thing. I had a professor one time say, Mr. Patton, evolution is just change. Don't you believe in change? And I said, well, sure I do. I've got some in my pocket, but I think we need to define our terms better if we're going to have an intelligent conversation. If you switch your meaning in the middle of your argument, you can prove almost anything. Now, from experience, I can agree with the statement that it's a nuisance to send a child to college. But you look on the law books, and being a public nuisance is a crime that you can go to jail for. And so when you switch definitions, you can prove that sending a kid to college is a crime, and you can go to jail for it. This is what they do. They make arguments based on the special theory, and they reach conclusions regarding the general theory. They switch definitions in the middle of their argument. And so they come up with just really rabid-sounding statements, like this one made by Richard Dawkins. It's absolutely safe to say if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, then that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked. Well, he knows that there are variations, and so he concludes there must be the general theory. That's the only way you can reach a statement like that. It illustrates the point made by Stephen Gould, who says, no myth deserves a more emphatic death than the idea that science is an inherently impartial and objective enterprise, yet it continues to thrive among working scientists because it serves us so well. Maxwell Planck, who is a Nobel laureate, says scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that's familiar with it. You got to have some funerals for science to progress, and unfortunately that's often the case. But what ought to be the case? When we talk about something being scientifically established, what do we mean? Sometimes it's just who hollers the loudest, and that's not good science. Basically, there are four criteria that are involved in scientific proof. It has to be a phenomenon that is observable, that is repeatable, that can be demonstrated by experiment, and that is falsifiable. Now, the last concept is probably the most unfamiliar in a general audience. Basically, that means testable. You have to be able to set up a test so that if this happens, it's verified. If this happens, it's falsified. And if it's not potentially falsifiable, a test so that you could refute it, then it's not testable. It's not a scientific conclusion. All four of these are criteria that must be met in order to have scientific proof. Well, let's examine the concept of evolution in this light. In the living world, can you observe evolution? G. Leonard Stebbins of Harvard says the reason the major steps of evolution have never been observed is that it requires millions of years. Well, I can understand that, but still, you don't observe it, which is the first criterion. It's not an observable phenomenon. Jeffrey Schwartz, professor of physical anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, says it was and still is the case that with the exception of DeJohnsy's claim about a new species of fruit fly, which did vary in one direction and then varied back when the environment was changed, it didn't accumulate. But anyway, with that exception, he says, the formulation of a new species by any mechanism has never been observed, Now, you'd think that you observe it all the time, the way it's presented in the textbooks, but no, it's never been, except for this little extra bump the fruit fly had that disappeared in another environment. You don't see it in the living world. Well, okay, but it takes millions of years, and so that's why you can't see it in the living world. You ought to see it, though, in the fossil record, which records what happens over millions of years. And notice what we read there, and we'll talk more about the fossil record later in the week, but Google of Harvard says the extreme rarity of the transitional forms in the fossil record, which is what you'd have to see evolution taking place, persists as the trade secret of paleontologists, the ones who study fossils. We view our data as so bad, we never see the very process we profess to study. We don't see it in the fossil record either. Or as D.B. Kitts of University of Oklahoma says in the journal Evolution, despite the promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it's presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists. This is not seen in the living world or in the fossil world. Well, what about the next criteria? Theodosius Dobzhansky, of course, talks about repeatability and experimental qualifications in his statement, The American Scientist. He says these evolutionary happenings are unique, unrepeatable, irreversible. You don't repeat them. He's talking about the change, for example, from Australopithecus, or the ape man, up to man. Well, that's not repeatable. That happened historically. The applicability of the experimental method to the study of such unique historical processes is severely restricted before all else by the time intervals, which far exceed the lifetime of any human, experimenter. So you can't repeat it. You can't set up an experiment to see it. Well, what about falsifiability? The testability. Well, when you're talking about historical processes, that's just not applicable. As Murray Eden of MIT says, one could propose a crucial experiment to check whether or not the theory was false or not. He's talking about true science, where you test, like in chemistry. But this cannot be done in evolution, he says. Taking in the broad sense, this is really all I meant when I called it tautologists in the first place. It can indeed explain anything. Of course, if it explains anything, then there's no observation that would refute it. It's not potentially falsifiable. It's not testable. Explaining whatever you might see is not good in science. You have to be able to test it and find a way to disprove it, or at least potentially. Commenting on that likewise, Colin Patterson, who's curator of the largest fossil museum in the world, in his textbook Evolution, says these processes are unique, unrepeatable, like the history of England. This part of the theory of evolution that has occurred is therefore a historical theory about unique events. Unique events are by definition not a part of science, for they're unrepeatable, not subject to test, not falsifiable. All four of these criteria are not met by the general theory of evolution. Now, the special theory is a different story. But let's talk about what the issue is, the general theory, and you don't observe it, you can't repeat it, you can't perform an experiment, it's not potentially falsified. It fails all four times. But people say, well, it's a proven scientific fact. They just don't know what science is about. Or they're not telling the truth. One of the two is, I think, necessarily true. Now, we need to acknowledge that it is true both of evolution and creation. Neither one of them are subject to scientific proof in this absolute sense. You can't repeat creation. You can't perform an experiment to demonstrate it. You could potentially falsify it. And I think evolution, there are some potentially falsifiable concepts, but certainly most of the arguments are not testable. Like the idea of survival of the fittest. How do you test that? How do you determine what the fittest is? Survival of the fittest is really survival of the ones that survive. There's no possible way to test it, and that's the case with most of the argumentation. Both creation and evolution, however, can be investigated scientifically. They cannot be proven in the absolute scientific sense, but that doesn't mean it's totally outside of science. We reach conclusions about things we can't observe and can't test scientifically based on what's called model comparison. Here is what we can observe, and here is what the idea we're testing, and we compare it with not direct observation, but implications for what we can observe. We look in biology and microbiology, and we see implications regarding creation and evolution. And we weigh the explanatory value of creation and evolution with regard to all of these sciences, and we see which one fits the facts best, which model explains what we can observe best. This is the concept of model comparison. It doesn't produce scientific proof. It produces a probabilistic, most likely conclusion. This is more scientific than this one. This is sometimes called the principle of Occam's razor or the principle of parsimony. But it is a scientific process, and it is the one that is applicable when we're dealing with creation and evolution. And we can reach scientific conclusions, not religious ones, about which one is the best scientific model. That's what we're going to be doing for the rest of the week. And that's the procedure that we'll be following. All right, let's see if some of you have some questions. Surely everybody understood that. You got no questions. All of that. Who has a question? Sometimes we have a hard time getting people started and then have a hard time getting them stopped. Yes, sir.
Did you not say yesterday that there have been some geologists who did not believe that you did work with and through the years of that study and come to the conclusion that they could be the way acceptable the Bible said that?
That doesn't usually take years. Yes. We had an example up here in Conway at the university there? UCA. Just a few years ago, we had three geology professors, all three of them worked for the state of Arkansas, who attended the series. They were there the first night asking rather antagonistic questions. The second night, there were more really information-seeking questions, and the third night, they were kind of quiet. And the fourth night, the leader came up to me and said, before we started, and said, we've been here for three nights, and after listening and checking the references that you gave, and by the way, we have handouts that has all the quotes that we're using that you'll have tonight. We've checked all of this. We've reached the conclusion that evolution just can't be true. We've got to start all over. Now tell us what books we need to read. And that was three geology professors in three nights. It doesn't take years. We see this regularly. I had one call me about 2 weeks ago from Alaska. He had his PhD from the University of Alaska. He said, my pastor made me look at your DVDs. He said, it changed my life. And he says, I want to order three more sets and I'm going to change some more lives. There are honest people out there, honest scientists. And we just need to get the information out. Most of them have no idea of the kind of evidence that's available because it's been censored from their education. Yes. Terms that are defined differently by different textbooks and whoever you listen to define the terms. And there's a wide variation in the meaning of those terms. The scientific process method we defined, and this is what's required to be scientific law, it doesn't meet that. Now, why do they say it's proved? We've had the experience of discussing in religion a certain doctrine, and we show people this is not taught in Scripture, they can't find it in Scripture, and they say, I believe it anyway. Why do they do that? It's exactly the same thing. It's not one bit of difference. People are not objective because they're scientists. They have the same ambitions and prejudices and determinations to succeed and win as do preachers sometimes. Yes. This is an argument that was devised by Haeckel back about the time of Darwin, that the embryos all look the same. Now, Haeckel was a liar. Now, I'm trying to remember whether I included that in this second part of the lecture or not. If not, we'll get to it. If you'll remind me, I'll show you the illustrations of that. That has been exposed as a fraud. It's been written up in the technical journals as a fraud. He was lying about it. They do not look the same. He drew them the same. They're not the same. They're dramatically different. But they're still in many of the textbooks, and about half of the textbooks have removed that argument because it's fraudulent. And it's been there since Darwin's time and still there in a significant number of them. It's just a lie. And it is in the handout. I can guarantee you that the reference and documentation for that is in the handout. Yes, ma'am. That's our subject Friday night. You're absolutely right. There ought to be... That's the only way you can see evolution from the fossils, is step-by-step progression. There ought to be these intermediate forms. As we saw from Kitts and from Gould, that's a trade secret of paleontologists. We don't see that in the fossil record, and we'll document that more fully Friday night. Lucy is a great, beautiful, perfect ape. And we'll demonstrate that Friday night. Yes. The drawings are impressive. but you can line up a tricycle and a bicycle and a motorcycle and a car, and that looks like a progression, but what have you proved? That'll be our subject Friday night. Yes. You're absolutely 100% correct, and I think that'll become more and more obvious each evening. People say, well, you know, how can they admit that, and here it is in print, but then turn around and say what they say in the textbooks? They're afraid you might get confused if you know all the facts, and so they just keep them to themselves. I was looking in a journal the other day about some of the evidence from caves over in Africa, and here were cave drawings by people maybe 1,000 years ago, and there was a perfect depiction of a Diplodocus. And this is in a journal I subscribe to. It's a technical journal. And they said, you know, here's humans with dinosaurs. I sure hope the creationists don't learn of this. You know, it's published right there. They're like, we can't read. But there seems to be a disconnect there. They say things in their journals they won't allow in the textbooks. Yes. You have more insight than a lot of people do. That's what makes the world go round. And grant money draws a lot of conclusions. And you've got to reach this conclusion or you don't feed your kids next month. And so what do you do? This makes a big difference. I've just in a presentation just a few weeks ago, one of the professors was just very upset. If we don't find answers for what Dr. Patton is saying, we're going to lose our grant money. This is their concern. But everybody's objective in just seeking truth as honestly as they, well, that's not the way it works. Now, there are some honest scientists, and there are some who are out to make a name for themselves and have a career and be a success. And that means more than the facts and the truth. And that's true in every discipline, including science. And has a tremendous influence. There is a tremendous amount of intimidation in academic circles. And these three professors actually were making their living from the state of Arkansas that we talked about there at Conway. They weren't depending on the university for their money. They were depending on it from the state. And so they had a little more independence than the professors normally do. But I have professors typically come up to me when I'm lecturing at universities and say, Dr. Patton, I agree with you. I just can't let it be known. I'd lose my job. And that happens 3 or 4 times everywhere I go. So, yes, your observation is absolutely correct. And we can... Jerry Bergman has just 3 earned doctorates, just published a book, over 1,000 pages, documenting all the discrimination and intimidation that has gone on that he's seen in the last 20 years. It's vicious. All right, let's take a break and come back, and we've got, I think, some very exciting things to show you in the second session.